When he was 13 years old, a young man, an honor student and kind of an all-American kid named Ryan White, contracted a deadly disease. It was thought that he would live about 6 months. As it turned out, Ryan and his mother fought that disease and the ignorance and the prejudice surrounding it for over 5.5 years. In April of 1990, Ryan White died. His mother, Jeannie White, continues now to fight against the ignorance and the prejudice that surrounds HIV and AIDS. I'm Susan McInnes for Conversations. It's with great pleasure that I welcome Jeannie White to Conversations on this edition.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you for joining us. Ryan contracted HIV because he was born with hemophilia. Can you tell us a little bit about hemophilia so people know what that is? And that was very unexpected in your life.
When Ryan was first born, he was circumcised and he bled for 3 days, and they finally realized that we have to do something. We have to find out what's wrong with this kid. They found out he was a classic hemophilia, meaning he had less than 1% clotting. A lot of people are kind of confused when they hear about hemophilia. They think of bleeder. And the problem with hemophilia really is it's a blood clotting disorder, but you bleed kind of internally instead of outwardly. Huh. The only thing is, it is serious if you ever have surgery. I know when he was first born, they told me that if he was ever in an auto accident, he probably would not live because he would bleed faster than what they could ever put blood into him. And they told me he could never have surgery. And they told me any major surgery anyway. And then they told me that, he would never be able to play contact sports. So, I mean, all along, I think we lived in and out of hospitals a lot because of his hemophilia. So,
did you protect him when he was little? I mean, so he wouldn't bump himself and bruise and fall down and...
I think at first you're very cautious about it because you're afraid of that. You're afraid of the disease, and you hear all these rumors about kids bleeding to death and all that. Padded cribs, and we padded his crib, and he wore a football helmet sometimes, you know, when he first started walking. And then we kind of felt like, well, that was kind of ridiculous. You know, he was not getting to live a normal life. We were trying to pamper him, kind of sheltering him for anything he had to do in life. So eventually he kind of learned what he could do and what he couldn't do, and we learned what he could do and what he couldn't do.
He tells a story in his book, My Story, about, and he probably was earlier than his memory, but about there being a great thump in the house and you leaping out of bed and discovering that your little delicate child had tossed himself out of the crib and was fine. Mm-hmm. So there were turning points for you where you stopped and looked at this boy and said, I mean, he's bruised, but this isn't life-threatening.
Right. I think we really thought that he had to live a normal life and that we couldn't be protective and want to run to his rescue, you know, every time he fell or bumped himself. Yeah. And really, we did. We kind of let him lead a normal life, even though he was in the hospital a lot.
How did you find out he had HIV?
Well, it was strange because when Ryan was first born, there was a product just approved by the Food and Drug Administration, and it was called Factor VIII. And it was experimental then, but Ryan was able to get that. And it was supposed to enable hemophiliacs to live almost a normal life. And they called it a miracle drug. That is how Ryan contracted AIDS, was we did not know the HIV virus could live in the Factor VIII.
Did the Factor VIII help him clot then? So it's more like my body or yours?
Yes, Ryan received Factor VIII twice a week, and that's the clotting agent found in blood. And it enabled him really to live relatively a normal life until he got a little older. And then sometimes if he did have a bad hemorrhage or a bad bleed, then he would have to have it more often. But Ryan was one of the very lucky ones because he did get it twice a week, whether he needed it or not.
And so that gave him kind of a level playing field,
very
so
much
to speak.
So.
Yeah. This is Jeannie White with us today on Conversations. As we've been talking about, her son Ryan died of AIDS or pneumocystis pneumonia when he was just 18 years old in 1990. Jeannie has been traveling the country for the past couple of years talking to people about HIV, talking to people about AIDS, and about the ignorance that surrounds both. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice, but we'll try to kind of proceed as normal here. What was it about Factor VIII, about the factor that brought HIV into his system. That's how is that contributed, I guess? That's what I want to know.
Well, the factor A is really a blood product. It's made from many thousands of donors of blood. And what happens is, we just found this out relatively recent within the last 4 years, so like how factor is made and where they go to get the blood. We found out they went to Miami, Chicago, San Francisco, New York City, Los Angeles, because they needed such volumes of blood. Mm-hmm. And what would happen then is they would pour all this blood into a container. They would spin it real fast and the clotting is sucked out. And that is just used for hemophiliacs. The rest of the blood is used for other things. What we didn't realize that one bad donor would contaminate the whole batch. Oh. So Ryan was not exposed maybe one time, 10 times. He was exposed maybe hundreds or thousands of times.
And that's because he got it twice a week, yes, plus when there was another problem more often than that.
And when you would go down to the hospital to pick up a factor, I would pick up like 10 to 12 boxes at a time, and they'd all be from the same lot number and batch number. You'd use that up before you go get any more. So it was a repeated process of infecting Ryan with the HIV virus.
People will worry about the blood supply hearing this, just because I think people aren't sure of the history of how blood is now screened. Is the blood supply for hemophiliacs and for other people who would need blood still in danger for HIV?
Well, I think it's relatively different, okay? What they found out with factor VIII is all they had to do was heat treat it and it would kill the HIV virus. But it was too late for thousands upon hemophiliacs. I think the process of determining now whether it's HIV, I mean, the blood is real safe. And I think for even factor VIII now, it's real safe because they have methods of screening the blood and the factor VIII to make sure that the HIV virus is not there.
Was this, it feels to me like emotionally it must have been like falling off a cliff to discover that something you were injecting into Brian to save his life actually was the thing that was going to kill him.
I think that was the hardest thing, to realize that had we had a choice, maybe we would have been a lot skeptical about giving the factor so freely. I mean, if we knew that the HIV virus lived in the factor, then we would definitely not be giving it, you know, only in like extreme emergencies. And I think that's where a lot of hemophiliac families feel like that we were wronged, that we weren't given a choice, that, you know, they kept saying, you know, to give it. Even at the point when the HIV virus started coming in the forefront, we were told that it was less than 1% chance of getting AIDS. Well, we thought then, you know, well, less than 1% is hardly anything. And because Ryan was one of the first children and first hemophiliacs diagnosed, this brought on a big concern for the CDC, because they were very alerted that Ryan had not ever had blood transfusions. There had been older hemophiliacs at that time who had gotten blood transfusions or blood clotting products, but they had also received blood transfusions. And with Ryan, he had not had blood transfusions, only blood clotting products.
So they thought it was like the wholesale changing of blood that created the problem?
But and then after Ryan was diagnosed and the CDC started investigating and realized this, then they started bringing in all hemophiliacs and found that the 80% of them was all HIV infected.
And how many people is that? How many people do you think were in Ryan's place?
I would think probably at least 8,000, 8,000 to 10,000, somewhere around in there.
Are there a lot of people in the nation with hemophilia, or
is this
a small group?
I think there is. I think there's 10,000, but as some of them have died, the new ones coming up, you know, are not infected.
So you think maybe an average of maybe 10,000 people in the population?
Yeah, at one time,
so
yes.
This is a very
and now they're that I would say it's very, very much lower than that now, because if you're 10 and under, then there's a good chance you've gotten a heat-treated factor. But I think a lot of the older hemophiliacs are not with us now.
Oh, people have benefited from the tragedy of other people. Or for them, lessons learned, I suppose. How do people get hemophilia?
Well, it's a hereditary disease, but it's a deformed gene, so it can happen anywhere. It was not ever in our family before. I'm a carrier. Women are carriers. They do not normally get hemophilia. It would be very rare for a woman to get hemophilia. So that's why a lot of boys and men have come down with this disease.
How is the gene deformed? How does that happen?
I don't know. It's just something in the system. Yeah.
So it can be two ways, either hereditary or by a deformed gene that comes into the genetic flow, so to speak. Had Ryan lived, no, he would not have passed it on because he's a boy, right?
Right. He wouldn't have been, no, just women are carriers.
Is your daughter affected?
Well, we've had Andrea checked twice, but for some reason they keep losing the results because the hospital does not have a chart on Andrea. And when the tests come back, they never know where to send it to, so it ends up in this dead file, so to speak. But she's been tested, but they feel like she must be negative, or else the hospital would have tried to research it more.
Okay. It must be an interesting position.
So hopefully she'll get tested again.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if there's anything else we need to know about Factor VIII. This has struck me. In 1984, when Ryan contracted HIV, there was some things known about HIV, and there was some understanding of how it was passed along. But I think most lay people, most people who weren't in medicine or science, really didn't know. When the doctor said to Ryan, and or to you about Ryan, that he had HIV, were you concerned for yourself and for Andrea?
Very much so. The CDC at that time came up to talk to me, and they assured me that no family member had ever come down with AIDS. So I really thought that everybody else knew a lot more about AIDS than I did. Mm-hmm. Because I informed the CDC, I said, you know, we're a real affectionate family. We hug, we kiss, we share drinks, you know. And I was kind of concerned because you hear about things, but they're so far in the background and you don't think they're ever going to affect you or infect you. And so you really kind of put it on a, you know, in the back of your mind, and you don't really concentrate and think about it until it happens. And then all of a sudden, you know, you try to think of all kind of instances where I may have handled Ryan's blood, that I've gotten stuck by needles. And there was a lot of times I've been stuck by needles and that I've handled Ryan's blood. I mean, I gave him 2 IVs a week, and sure, he had bloody noses, you know, and so forth. And so it was really, it was a really learning experience for all of us, but then the CDC did a very thorough job in educating us, and that was back in 1984. The only thing is, I thought everybody else knew more about AIDS than that, and I was the one that really knew more, I guess, than a lot of other people.
Ryan's story hit the headlines, and I think this is the quickest way to get to some of the ignorance that kind of fell into your lives. Ryan's story hit the headlines when he said, Mom, I want to go back to school. And the school essentially said, no, you can't come back. But that was a car crash of his life and your life against the ignorance of a community, wasn't it?
Very much so. Ryan was diagnosed with full-blown AIDS. So he was
sick when you knew. Yeah.
Yeah, he was HIV positive for probably 2 to 4 years, maybe even longer. We didn't know it. And so therefore, I mean, people really thought that you had to do something bad or wrong to get this disease at that time. And they really didn't want to think that people in the general community could get this disease. It was kind of labeled a gay IV drug user disease, and that you had to do something wrong or otherwise you didn't get it. So we faced that right on. I mean, even within the church, we saw the church turn away because, you know, people really felt like this was God's punishment to people, you know, for getting this disease. And so we learned a lot how the gay and IV drug users were treated because we were being treated the same way. So it was easy to fall into this category, I guess, where you were realizing how bad discrimination can get and how awful it can be when you really didn't maybe think about it before. I mean, even from the black community from a long time ago, you know, if you've never been discriminated against, you kind of don't know how that feels until it really happens to you.
This was a shock for you.
Very much so.
Yeah. Ryan White, in conjunction with Anne Marie Cunningham, wrote a book called Ryan White, My Own Story, that is a Signet paperback. It has been recommended by reading circles in Kansas and in Ohio as an excellent book for young children. It's been recommended as an excellent book on science because it deals so much with the medical side of AIDS for young children as well. And I must say, it's an awfully good read. It's a very good book, and it puts you in touch with what happened to this young man and to his family. I bring this up at this time because I was impressed over and over again with the level of faith that Ryan had spiritual faith in a God and the faith that you have had. Was this, as you've brought up, your church did not accept you and Ryan and Andrea as a family into the fold once it was learned he had AIDS. And I kept wondering how your faith survived that.
Well, I think because Ryan had such a spiritual feeling within himself, and when he was first diagnosed, I came into the room to see him, and he said, "Mom," he said, Jesus just came and spoke to me." And I'm like, I'm in shock, and I'm like, "Are you sure it wasn't a doctor or a nurse in a white coat, you know?" And he said, "No, Mom." And I said, "Well, what did he say?" And he said, "He told me I had nothing to fear, that I was going to be taken care of." And I saw an inner peace within Ryan from that very day afterwards. I mean, he was not frightened, he was not scared. And they had only given him 3 to 6 months to live. Right. So we kind of made a pact. We had always said prayers anyway. But we kind of made a pact that every day we were going to say, "Thank you, Lord, for another day." And we had 5.5 years. And we had a lot of days to say, "Lord, thank you for another day."
How do you feel about the people around you who weren't able to share that faith and that grace?
Well, I think we were very lucky because my family, I think we kept our faith. I think we were really let down by people. But as far as not from, we didn't feel let down by God at all. I think we were let down by people.
Uh-huh. Many people would say that the disease was an act of God letting you down.
Well, I think we never questioned, like, why me? I think that's, you know, Ryan had a very eloquent statement, you know, that he'd say, you know, "Well, you know, I don't blame anybody for this disease. You know, maybe God's trying to tell me something. Maybe the Lord's trying to lead my life a different way." And he said, "I'll just have to make the best of whatever time I have left."
Mm-hmm. Why did you and Ryan decide to fight the school district to go to school? I mean, why was this a big issue?
I think because we saw how the disease was tearing everyone apart because they were uneducated. It's strange because when Ryan was first diagnosed, I mean, we didn't think he was going to live long enough to even be able to go back to school.
That's what I'm thinking.
And he started getting so healthy. People say, "Why did you go public?" Well, we never went public. His two school teachers came down to see him at Christmas time, right after he was diagnosed, and they wanted to know what was wrong with him. And I didn't think to hide it. I mean, these were school teachers. I thought they knew about AIDS. And they brought cards and letters, and I said, "You can go in and see him." And they said, "Oh, no, that's all right." And I said, "No, really, all you have to do is put on a gown and gloves, and you can go in and see him." And they said, "Oh, no, that's all right." And they would not go in and see him.
They were scared.
And so that's the first chance I saw, but they knew it then. I mean, and so it took about 2 weeks after that before we slowly started hearing the results that everybody knew. A young boy from Kokomo, Indiana had AIDS, and finally everybody knew it was Ryan White. And so, but we really didn't think, I didn't think Ryan would be discriminated against. I thought that they'd know he wasn't gay and an IV drug user. But we learned it didn't matter. I mean, the disease had a label to it, in that, you know, we had to suffer the consequences just like everybody else was going through at the time.
What did people think? How did people think Ryan would give HIV AIDS to them? That's what it was about.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. They thought that you could get it from kissing, tears, sweat, and saliva. And they thought that, you know, if he coughed or if he sneezed, the germs would just go skipping over
everywhere.
And Ryan used to laugh. He'd say, "Mom, if they would only think about it, that I went to school with these kids when I was HIV positive for at least 2 to 4 years." Mm-hmm. And he said, "They better hope that you can't get it that way. Because if you could, they'd already all have it."
Yeah.
Just like I have it.
And you, and
yes,
all the
everybody.
Teachers and all the preachers and everyone else.
But, you know, he would kind of find a lot of humor in it because he knew they just didn't understand and they were uneducated. And sometimes I would get so angry and he'd say, "Well, Mom, they're just trying to protect their own kids like you're trying to protect me." Yeah. But he said, "They don't understand, so it's up to us to make sure they do understand."
What's your sense about what happens to people when ignorance and prejudice and fear come together? Like so few other people, you've seen this right up front, this I don't know, I was thinking about people throwing things in your yard and refusing to touch you. And
the lies, the fear, the panic. Mm-hmm. It's like a panic button's been pushed or something where, you know, it seems like everybody's on attack. Everybody's waiting for you to do something wrong. They're trying to discredit you just to make sure that they're right. I think the point of us just trying to get Ryan in school was such a minor problem to me, but it was their major problem. Mm-hmm. To me, I was just trying to keep my son alive as long as possible by making his life active and as normal as possible. And that included going to school, where I think they thought that, you know, this was who won and who lost. Uh-huh. I think they got caught up on a bandwagon that they were scared. It was like, you know, we don't want this kid giving our kids AIDS, and, you know, we were going to have to worry about it. They thought they were really going to have to worry about it because they were uneducated.
There was a television story made about Ryan, the Ryan White story, and that enabled y'all to consider a move to a community where you thought you wouldn't be quite so embattled as you felt in Kokomo. And that was true. Why did the people, what was it about the people or the situation in Cicero, Indiana, that allowed them to embrace you, embrace Ryan, bring him into school? I mean, it was an incredibly proactive way of embracing him and bringing him into school. What was it about that community that let that happen?
We were criticized quite publicly for doing the movie. We, even though Ryan had won the right to go back to school, criticized. They said, you know, I was exploiting my son and that we were in it for the money. We were really criticized a lot. And the movie was the best thing that ever happened to us because it enabled us to move out of a community that was not going to accept us no matter what. I mean, they thought we condemned their town. They thought we brought a lot of bad economics into their community. Instead of saying, you know, that they did it, it was always, you know, Jeannie and Ryan, you know, did this to our community. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're suffering now, is because they did it. Instead of thinking that they were uneducated, they didn't want to be educated. And even though we won the right to attend school there, the prejudice was still there. I mean, we had to live AIDS every day of our life. And so it was really nice when we got this offer to do a movie, because we had three different movie companies wanting to do a movie about us. And most people don't have that, that choice. So Ryan became quite an interviewer, and he started interviewing them. And he said right away, he said, okay, what have you done? And they said that they did Bill about a mentally retarded man and Adam Walsh about a little boy who was kidnapped from Sears. So it became such a delight to see Ryan picking and choosing who was going to do our movie. And it was the Landsberg Company. So I was very pleased. And we got to, Ryan says, well, you can do it provided I can be on location the whole time you do it. So
He was quite a participant.
Right. Because he was so healthy, he got to participate in the movie. And it was one of the greatest health-wise times of his life because the AZT was working and he was very healthy. And 13, 14-hour days he spent, and he made a lot of great friends. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a great support team with the movie people, plus it enabled to us to move out of Kokomo, where before we did not have the money or the funds to move.
You know, something about the filming period, I think people who've never done something like that would see this as all full of glitter in Hollywood, but it seemed very down to earth and very much family oriented, the crew and your mm-hmm. family and the like. It seemed kind of like a very healthy experience in terms of American values.
It was very healthy. We filmed it in North Carolina, and it was a lot of kids on the set that was not afraid to be around Ryan. It's strange because we filmed at a elementary school, the school part, and we used regular kids on some of it. And the kids were like so excited, you know, especially to meet Lucas. Well, we thought that we might have a problem with them wanting to meet Ryan. But we did not have Ryan show up the first day of school, and as a precautionary measure. And Lucas Haas arrives on the set, and the kids could care less. I mean, the kids were like, where's Ryan? Where's Ooh. Ryan? Ooh. And here Lucas was the star.
Right.
But the kids wanted to meet Ryan. And it was very exciting for them because they called back and they said, hey, these kids want to meet Ryan. Bring him over. You know, so there was no problem. And this is in North Carolina, so I think they were very proud to have the story, and I'm sure there was a lot of education being done at that school too before prior to the movie.
This time when you needed some heartwarming, and it happened.
Right, very much so. And then we moved, and it seemed like the student body got behind Ryan. We were very fortunate that the student body president lived two doors down from us, which we didn't know at the time.
This is in Cicero?
In Cicero. Yeah.
And she came to visit.
And it's only 30 miles away, and you wouldn't think there'd be that much difference, but there was. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to get Ryan accepted into the school. So she did a lot of education. They had a lot of people come in, talk to the parents, talk to the kids. And so to make Ryan's first day of school, you know, everything went very smoothly.
Do you think it's just kind of two sides of the human coin, that in one place ignorance took over and in the other place compassion took over?
I think they were able to see what they would look like if they reacted the same way Kokomo did. And they did not want their town to be that way too. Especially after 2 years later down the road, when they realized it was because they were uneducated. I think education plays such a big part in the acceptance of an AIDS person, and also as a preventative for people getting AIDS. I mean, I think education is our number one asset.
The student body group and the faculty at the Cicero High School did a good deal to educate parents and kids going to the high school.
Both, and they had several. They did not stop at just having one person come in to talk to them about AIDS. It was a repeated process to where they had several. As soon as they heard that Ryan was going to be moving into the community, which was like May, right before school let out the previous year, they had educators come in. And then they had, the first week of school, they had a new process to where they had brought in other educators just to prepare, just to make sure there was anybody that still had problems with it, that they could confront them and reassure them that they were not going to get HIV.
On this edition of Conversations, we're talking with Jeannie White, the mother of Ryan White, who became known to the nation and internationally for a disease that cut his life short, and also for his efforts and the efforts on the part of his mother and family to break down the ignorance and the prejudice that surrounds HIV and AIDS. I'm Susan McInnes. On this edition, we're talking with Jeannie White. This made all the difference in the world to Ryan going to school and to your family, you and Andrea, as you began to settle into Cicero, didn't it?
It made a great difference. We could go back to a normal life. And it was strange because I saw a change in Ryan where he didn't feel like shut out because he had AIDS. He felt like he had other people fighting it with him. And the kids were wanting to get involved with him. They were wanting to do some specials that he was doing. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be involved in his life and in his fight. So it was really kind of neat because the kids were backing him and supporting him 100%. And he had a job. He had a job at a Maui skateboard shop. I mean, he was starting to do things that he felt proud to do himself. He did a 3-2-1 contact special that was nominated for an Emmy. He did a Phil Donahue special. He did he spoke before 10,000 teachers at the Superdome,
right,
because he said they definitely needed educating. And he spoke before the Presidential AIDS Commission. So he slowly started doing things then that he felt very proud of himself for doing. And I think that was his greatest accomplishments, was really after we moved and how he felt so good about himself. You know, he felt like he could make a difference.
Mm-hmm. I don't think everyone could have taken on the maturity, the responsibility, and the wisdom this boy seems to have shown in 5 years of his life, when between 13 and 18 he fought this disease. You think your son was remarkable, not just an ordinary kid?
I think he was far above his years in attitude, intelligence, everything. I think he had so much compassion for people. I think he faced everything with a smile, but I think he wasn't afraid to die. It was something like, you know, that there was an inner peace within Ryan. And I think that was a lot part of his spiritual background, inner peace within himself, that, you know, you live each day to the fullest and you do as much as you can. And I think, yes, he hoped for a cure. He once said that, you know, when he was only given 3 to 6 months to live, he said, if I could live 5 years with AIDS, he said, I know there'll be a cure. Yeah. He lived 5.5 years and we're nowhere closer. So I think it's really, you know, he could face this disease with a smile. And I think the smile is what kind of attached everybody to Ryan, was because every time they saw him, he had this smile on his face.
How was this for Andrea? Do you have another child in this family, just 2 years younger than Ryan, who's mm-hmm. growing up into, as you and Ryan and Andrea all expected, a regular family in Kokomo, and suddenly life is kind of ripped out of your hands and returned to you transformed. How did Andrea do, and how does she do with this change in this life?
Well, I think siblings, definitely, people have no idea how hard it is on families. I mean, I think they see the person infected with AIDS and they see that suffering. But I don't think they ever think about the siblings. I had a hard time with Andrea. Andrea thought her brother got all this attention and nothing was ever going to happen to him. And it was really a shock to her when he died. I had a lot of problems with her. She never wanted to come home because when she came home, she had to realize her brother wasn't there. And finally one day, I was at nighttime and I told her, I said, Andrea, I said, we're going to sit down and talk and we can be here 2 hours, we can be here all night. And she said, Mom, AIDS took my brother's life. She goes, we lived AIDS every day for 5.5 years and now we don't have it anymore. And she said, I don't ever want to hear that word ever again. Mm. And it was kind of strange because I was just starting to be very active. I was starting to go to Washington, D.C. to work on the Ryan White Care Bill that Senator Kennedy and Hatch wanted me to come work on. And it was something we had to talk out. And I really felt for her feelings, but I also felt like I couldn't quit either. So we talked it out and she said, well, as long as if you can do it like a job. She said, you know, I just don't want to live every day, all weekends, everything, live everything AIDS like it was. And it was kind of strange because she had always wanted to be an air traffic controller. And a few months later, after Ryan died, I had mentioned to somebody she wanted to be an air traffic controller. And she said, no, Mom. She goes, I want to go into infectious disease. So, I mean, I saw her change within herself. After a little bit of grieving and started thinking about what she really wanted to do with her life. And she wanted to help other people with HIV. And I was so impressed with her. And she works out now at the foundation. She answers some of the mail. And she's in college now. So
she's 20 now?
Yeah, she's 20. And she is a very wonderful young lady. I'm very proud of her.
And are you managing to do this like a job?
Can
you?
Well, yeah, it's still kind of, I mean, I think when you're involved with AIDS, it's very hard for it to be like a job. There has to be a lot of care inside. There has to be a lot of compassion. And, you know, it just doesn't quit like a 9-to-5 job. Yeah. I mean, because you meet people at all hours of the night. I hear from people at all hours of the night. And I talk with them. I talk to other family members. And plus, the more people that I knew that was living with this disease, I also have had to watch die from this disease. So, I mean, it's a daily whenever I return from a trip I always have to face a lot of people that's just becoming infected and also some people that I have just lost and they have died. So it's kind of like a 24-hour job, but I try to get away from it too. I try at home to not quite be so attentive, like on the telephone all the time. I try to have hobbies and crafts and stuff I do, and I try to get away, just my husband and me, and we have a stepson, Stephen, who is 15, and Andrea. I try to do things with them.
You're making a life for yourself, right, as much as this other life that's still very important to you. This is Conversations. We're talking with Jeannie White. Jeannie White was born in Kokomo, Indiana, worked for Delco Electronics, which is a branch of General Motors, as what they called a Delco Dolly for years. Women who worked for Delco Electronics were Delco Dollies. We've mentioned that Ryan's sister's name is Andrea, 2 years younger than Ryan. She was a champion roller skater when she was a youngster. Jeannie White has been working on behalf of HIV and AIDS education for the last several years. This is Conversations. We're talking today with Jeannie White. I want to ask you about how you feel about how parents should talk to their kids about HIV. Ryan didn't contract HIV through sex, which is one of the ways that people can get it, or through drug use, which is another way. He contracted HIV through a blood product that was contaminated. I wonder if, though, you've reflected on how you would have talked to Ryan about sex if he didn't have HIV, and how that experience has affected how you might talk to him or how you've talked to Andrea now.
Well, I mean, because I've been...
I'm so nervous about this. This is why I'm wondering.
Well, I think we need to be nervous about it, because I think our kids are not coming to us and telling us, Mom, Dad, I'm having sex. And as parents, we like to believe that our kids are not having sex. So, I mean, I think there's a gap there to where nobody is really being honest with our kids. And even if you talk to kids, I'm not sure they're going to tell you, you know, even if you try to sit down and have an open relationship with them. So I think we have to kind of be prepared and in our minds think that they are having sex. And, okay, now what can we do?
Get over that hump first.
We have an HIV virus now that we know you get it from sex especially. And we're all going to have sex. I think that's one thing. I mean, every person in our lifetime normally will have sex. So everybody is at risk for this disease. Now, not everybody does drugs. Not everybody shares needles. But everybody in this country has sex, almost. And I think it's everybody's disease. So then we have to think, okay, how are we going to address this? And the Ryan White Foundation, which we deal with teens and adolescents, we definitely feel like abstinence is the only answer. To start preaching abstinence at fourth and fifth grade levels, but not just once at one time, every year, continuously, because that way you also get to the people who have religious and moral issues that surround this disease. You also are educating those people. Mm-hmm. The only thing is, you have to be reasonable and practical too. You also have kids who are juvenile detention centers. You have kids who are not even juvenile detention, but I'm saying these kids are into prostitution, a lot of them, and stuff like that. And there is a place where you have to start discussing protection.
Because it's the most vulnerable kids.
Right. I mean, kids who may be because of living conditions or whatever, kids maybe in New York City or Washington, D.C., where, you know, if you try to talk abstinence to a certain group of young people, I mean, they're going to say, you know, well, we have sex 2 and 3 times a week, you know. And so then those are the kids I think we have to really target. I think we need to teach kids to respect their bodies, though, that you die from this disease, that if you can't look at somebody and say, I'm willing to die for you, then you should not be having sex. Mm-hmm. That is what the Ryan White Foundation, that's what we believe in. Now, if kids come to you and say, you know, well, I've already had this many sexual partners, you know, I'm a prostitute, I mean, of course you don't want them to be prostitutes. But at the same time, I mean, they have to know how to protect themselves. We have to save their lives, too. Their lives have to be just as important. And I've met a lot of people who I thought people had choices kind of in their life, especially like whether they were prostitutes or not. And I have found that I met a lady in California, a black lady who has been on the street since she was 5 years old. She's done heroin, cocaine. She's done everything. She was a prostitute, and she was dying of AIDS. I mean, and so you see these people, and you think, and I looked at Norma, and I think, you know, she never really had a chance in life. She didn't have a family like I had, loving parents. Ryan had a loving parent. Some people do not have that. And I think the most important thing for a person with AIDS is to have that supportive family and the siblings and the family to still be with them suffering from this disease.
If you had some advice to give to a loving parent, a mother or father or both, about their kid who is like Ryan, a normal all-American kid, about HIV, what would you say to them? Not to the parent of the runaway child or the prostitute who may not be catchable, that mm-hmm. may not be able to bring that child back, but what about the kids who are playing softball and football and going to classes and dating? And
I would say to try to make every day as normal as possible. I would say to make sure you include plenty of love and family unity. It's strange because I deal with a lot of mothers who have gay sons, and this disease has been so discriminatory. But I like to think one thing: God doesn't punish somebody for loving somebody else. And I think we need to get over the bitter and the hostility of this disease of discriminating and blaming people for this disease. This disease is everybody's disease. It doesn't care whether you're rich, black, a cheerleader, or a football player. I mean, this disease doesn't care. You know, if you have sex, you're at risk for this disease.
This is culturally, there are such big mountains between us and understanding. Our culture runs away from people with a different sexual orientation. It runs away from drug abuse. It even runs away from people who are ill. So there's a kind of a huge gap between America and understanding HIV and AIDS.
Very much so.
Yeah. Jeannie White with us today on Conversations. One of the things that you have been doing is talking to officials, mm-hmm. the nation's Congress. While you are in Alaska, you have talked to the legislature about a mandatory education bill. What's that bill about, and what have you said to them while you're in the state?
Well, I've done a lot of lobbying. I worked on the Ryan White Care Bill with Senator Kennedy and Hatch. And here in Alaska, I have lobbied for the Student Healthy Student Act.
Right.
That I've lobbied for the Healthy Student Act. And it's very important to me for everybody to get involved with this disease and for all states to recognize that it is a problem. You know, maybe the numbers aren't as bad as New York and Chicago and Washington, D.C., but we ought to be thankful that they're not. We've got a chance to do something about it, this disease, before it gets to those kind of numbers. Don't wait till it gets to those numbers before we say, you know, we need to do something about this disease. Let's do it now. Let's educate all of our young people, especially our young people today, and do something about this disease to ward off so we don't become Washington, D.C. or New York City or Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Are there bills like this in other states in the union, as far as you know, that are working on making health education in schools mandatory?
I think everybody would like for there to be mandated. I think in a way, I know with the NEA, it's mandated that you have AIDS education in schools, but it's strange, it's always been left up to the school or the teacher of how much they devote to that. Mm-hmm. 5, 10, 15 minutes of it, you know, or whether some schools might do a whole day or an hour. And I think it's very important that we're talking about $39,000 here in Alaska, which is hardly nothing.
It's the cost.
I mean, it should not even be questioning it. I think it's very important for us to think back and say, you know, the health care of one person with AIDS is three times that amount of money, and we need to do something to prevent our kids from coming down with HIV. And education is our only cure for this disease right now.
What were the bills like with Ryan?
Well, we were very lucky. We had Blue Cross, very, very lucky, because I think we were fortunate because the medical bills, Ryan had two different hospital stays that were over $100,000. And so we had numerous ones after that, even for his factor. During the last 6 months of his life, he had factor, which runs $350 a shot. Mm. And he had that for every day because he had no platelets. So because of his clotting problem too, I mean, our bills were $100,000 a month easy.
Mm-hmm.
So we were very fortunate that we had insurance. But at the same time, most people. And so somebody's going to have to absorb that cost. And it's going to have to be the state. We need to wipe out this disease so we can wipe out the medical bills of people with HIV by saying that we're going to save lives too.
Mm-hmm. Even if you say that the insurance bill absorbed the cost, that it rolls on down
right.
the line to everybody else.
Yes, yeah. So somebody's going to be paying for it.
That's right. That's right. You talked about a bill that Senator Kennedy and Senator Orrin Hatch wrote and encouraged. It's called the CARE Bill. What is that? Some people are familiar with it, just call it the Ryan White Act.
Right. That's yeah. what most people know it as, the Ryan White CARE Bill. That is a social service bill to help people with AIDS. It's to help them get medicine. It's to help them to get social services for AIDS. Because we felt like by people coming forth early on in the disease and by getting them some kind of funding to help them get treatment early, it will prolong their life. And I worked very hard for that. It was in a time when I really didn't think that I could, because it was only like about 3 or 4 days after Ryan's death. It was 3 or 4 days after we buried him. It was like a week after he died. But it was, you know, a time where I wanted to give up and feel sorry for myself. And I'm very thankful for Senator Kennedy and Hatch, both for just encouraging me and trying to say, you know, Ryan's got a chance to make a world of difference, and you do, in memory of Ryan, and please come to Washington, D.C. And I'm saying no, and they're saying yes, please, you know. It's so fresh on everybody's minds, and it was. I mean, it was very easy talking to, once you're prepped a little bit and you kind of know what's going on, I mean, you're angered just enough, I think, to be good at it. You know, you're kind of mad. You've lost your son, and you feel like that nobody's listening, and nobody cares if any more people die of this disease. And so I think that because you have a little bit of anger in you, you're probably better off than going and standing up to these people. You know, because I always felt like, you know, I was nobody. I mean, I was like a mom, and I always felt like, you know, I wasn't anybody special. But I mean, even when up against senators, I felt like, you know, I could do it. This was something I know about. I lost my son to this disease. We had to fight everything. We fought this disease through discrimination, you know, and the disease itself at a very early on. So I felt like this is one thing that I know about. Mm-hmm. So that's how I can talk about it. I mean, maybe I can put a face to this disease to where people can kind of change their views on this disease, and to show that this is everybody's disease. I mean, if my son can get it, then anybody's son can get it. Now, anybody can get it.
Do you think you're making headway against ignorance and prejudice? Do you think the movement for educating this nation is moving ahead?
I think the movement is moving ahead, but I think everybody's kind of still feels like it's not their problem. It's not their disease, and it's going to have to hit every household before you get everybody involved. And I hope that doesn't ever happen, because it's going to be really too late then to try to save a lot of lives. I mean, I look at 10 years down the road, and the people are going to say, like, why didn't you do something if you knew it was going to get this bad? They're going to blame the government. They're going to say, you know, if you knew it was going to get this bad, why didn't you do something? And we're going to say, we tried, but we couldn't get nobody to listen. Why does it have to hit every neighbor or every family before we think it's a problem, before we think it's like cancer? Mm-hmm. You know, this is something we can do something about now.
You mean like cancer that everybody knows somebody?
Yeah, everybody knows cancer about now, family. You know, and it's somewhere in everybody's family now. But AIDS is a much more disastrous disease than cancer, because it can be prevented. We know that. And it's something that we're all going to have to think, that maybe there's going to be a lot of things out there that we're going to have to take charge of our lives. We're going to have to educate ourselves to where we can fight a lot of these diseases.
Do you see yourself as an unusual person?
I think I see myself kind of as a strong person, but I also feel like I have a lot of family values. My husband, I think I'm a liberal conservative. I mean, I don't know. I think family values are the most important thing in life. I think
we hear about that a lot. What does that mean to you? What
is it? Well, I think, you know, material things and how much you have is not as important as what your family and what you have at home. I mean, when you lose your son, no amount of money could have brought Ryan back. So money is nothing. And I think that's something we really have to kind of, money cannot buy your health.
When you think about a typical day in your household, what is that like in terms of what you're talking about? Love, family values?
Well, I think since I'm married now and I have a husband, I mean, it's easy to devote a lot of time to him. My daughter just recently moved back. It's just trying to do things together, trying to plan supper around the same time with each other, trying to plan trips. We went out to Michael Jackson's ranch this last summer, which was a lot of fun, and my new family got to go. And you know, trying to plan time to where everybody is still together, and of an evening especially. We try not to do anything of an evening. my husband has hobbies, and he likes to work on Corvettes and stuff like that, redo them. And I have my own hobbies. I mean, we try to really stay involved in doing things or centered around the home.
Things to do and family doing. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Now, you said Michael Jackson. People who don't necessarily know would be surprised to hear you say, oh, yes, and we planned a trip out to see Michael.
Yeah.
There were some fairly unusual people who gravitated towards your family, or fairly remarkable people who gravitated towards your family while Ryan was ill, and they've stayed with you
right. In
your lives. Elton John and Michael Jackson have formed a bond with your family.
Yeah, I think Elton and Michael both are very... sincere people. I think they were very impressed with Ryan, and I think at first they probably came around Ryan because they felt sorry for this poor little boy with AIDS. But once you met Ryan, you didn't feel sorry for him, and that's why Ryan wanted it. And I think everybody that met Ryan was always so impressed with him that they just wanted to be friends with him. I mean, there was a lot. There was Greg Louganis, there was Max Headroom, there was Charlie Sheen. I mean, I think Ryan impressed so many people along the way because seeing how this boy, you know, was always full of fun and laughter and games, and, you know, he had a sense of humor, and, you know, and how he didn't blame anybody for his disease. So I think a lot of people, Ryan touched them when, you know, at first they were trying to touch him, and then he ended up touching them.
If you want to read about Ryan's life and his battle, and Jeannie White's life and battle, it's very well told in a story called Ryan White, My Own Story. It was co-written between Ryan White and Anne Marie Cunningham. When Ryan was invited to do a show on 321 Contact, a public television program, he met Anne Marie Cunningham, who was also working on and writing that program. And Jeannie says he was so impressed with her that when people clamored for his story in print, he asked Anne Marie if she would write it with him. They did it together. As I've said, this book has been recommended for both adults and teens as a way to learn about a remarkable kid and about a disease that is remarkable for its devastation. The book is called Ryan White, My Own Story. It's a Signet paperback book. It's also on audio tape, and you can find it in both ways. We're talking with Jeannie White on Conversations. There are people who will have been listening to you and I talk for the last hour and whose heart has been touched. If people want to do something about HIV, what do you think that they should do?
I think they should notify their local AIDS organizations. I think in getting involved, I think by one thing they can push to have AIDS education in schools. I think they can get involved. They can be a buddy, be a buddy to somebody with AIDS. There's a lot of things that people can do to try to help with this disease. You can help a person with AIDS. You can also do an education to try to prevent the disease. And also there's places where you can go to help remember the people who have died of AIDS. You can make a quilt for somebody, and maybe you don't even know somebody personally, but somebody, an elderly person who's lost a son, or somebody might want to make a quilt for that person. So I really think there's a lot of things that people can do to show that they care. Money is always needed, of course. I mean, every AIDS organization needs money. I think a lot of people think that there's a lot of money out there, but it seems not to be divided in the right quantities, you know, to the different areas. I think there's a lot of money maybe in your larger cities like Los Angeles and New York, but I don't think it has filtrated down to the states as much as it should.
Something I've been curious about, and I've been kind of hesitant to ask you, but when you think about your church, what should it have done? What should churches be doing about this disease? Churches are up against this what they feel is a moral issue, mm-hmm. about behavior and AIDS, and if people didn't behave a certain way, they wouldn't get sick, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What do you feel that churches should be doing, or do you not feel?
I think the churches should be very active in this disease. I mean, because as it strikes more and more people, this is not a gay IV drug use disease. It never has been, only here in the United States. In Africa, it's been a heterosexual disease. I think we, of all people who need compassion and understanding and need faith and the spiritual guidance, it's people with AIDS. And I don't care whether you're gay, straight, white, black, everybody needs an inner faith. And the positive feeling that people are willing to do something, they have a place to go, that they need to go to. I like to say again, I don't think God punishes people for loving somebody else. So I don't want to be judgmental, and I don't ever plan to be. I mean, it's something that I think, you know, we have to look beyond ourselves and look at a person for who they are and what they've accomplished in life.
Jeannie White, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's been a good hour. This is Conversations. We've been talking today with Jeannie White, the mother of Ryan White, and an activist against ignorance and prejudice and for the education of HIV and AIDS. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks. I hope you join me again next week.